Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Mark van Vught is a wonderful award-winning composer and jazz guitarist from the Netherlands. In this episode, you'll be introduced to several beautiful guitars in his collection that are featured in his new solo album, The Lonely Coyote. And you'll also get to hear stories from his travels and his perspectives about different musical scenes, composing, and some of the biggest challenges now for musicians worldwide. This is available as both a podcast and video. See the link in the description, along with a link to Mark's work and timestamps. Please follow and review this podcast to help new listeners discover Mark van Vught and all the incredible musicians featured in this unique series. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Leah. Thanks for asking me.
So I checked with you the pronunciation of your name. I think I can approximate it. Van Vught.
That's very good. Yeah, it's a difficult name, but yeah, you're doing well.
And you have a very long and wonderful partnership with the singer Ineke van Doorn.
Yes.
And for those people who are fans of your duo and other projects you've done together, they'll be happy to hear that she'll be featured on season 3 coming up of the podcast.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So thank you so much for this beautiful recording of Simian, which we're going to play now. Can you talk a little bit about that song and the guitar that's played on?
Yeah, the song I wrote about 5 years ago when I was staying in the south of France. That's what we do quite often. It's not specifically France, but we sort of go somewhere where we can stay for a couple of weeks to write, work on music, work on new music. And at that moment, we were staying in the south of France, about 40 kilometers down the Mont Ventoux, which is a very famous mountain in France. And we were staying there in a house, and I have been writing quite a lot of music, and I dedicated one of the pieces to that little town. It's a gorgeous little town. It's the sort of proverbial Provence, you know, the French Provence. When you're there at the right time, of the year, it's full of the lavender. It's just a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You've been composing music almost as soon as you started playing, it strikes me. And I was curious, the titles come to you after you've written the music sometimes, or are you often inspired by something to write specific music?
I'm an incredible fast writer, and I'm much slower in words. Mm-hmm. So most of the time I write, and then I sort of think about what inspired me, and then I'll work from that. It's mm-hmm. hardly ever the other way around.
Yeah.
It's also, I write a lot of songs in combination with Ineke, my partner in crime and in life. She writes the lyrics most of the time, and I write the music. But we work always music first. Mm-hmm. So that's just how I work.
Yeah. So Simeon has a beautiful Latin groove, kind of bossa nova. I don't know if I'm correct about that, but a couple of your tunes on the album, definitely, that we're going to talk about, have that. And you had go back way to the beginning of your musical career with Brazilian music. And how did you get influenced by that music living in the Netherlands?
Yeah, it's a bit strange, actually, especially at that time of the, you know, at that time, because there was a period when I was about 16 or 17, for about, I think, 3 or 4 years, I only listened to Latin American music. Mm-hmm. I somehow got hold of some albums and was totally crazy about it. And that's what I listened to. And it was especially strange because at that time it was very difficult to get that music. But I was so mesmerized by what was happening in that music that I just found out ways to find that music. I started studying in Utrecht. And before that, I grew up in a small village in the south of the Netherlands. And then I went up to Utrecht to study there. And they had a library, and that library had a music department, and they had an incredible collection of Latin music, and specifically Brazilian music, and more specifically, I was totally knocked out by the music of Herberto Gismonti, mm-hmm. and specifically the album Sol do Meu Dia. That sort of was a life changer for me. When I heard that album, it's with Colin Walcott on percussion, Herberto playing guitar, and Ralph Towner playing guitar, and Jan Garbrek on saxophone. And it still is, I think, an incredible album.
Yeah, I went and listened to it when I read that album had influenced you.
Wow.
And I think you're the third or fourth guest who said how much his music has influenced them. He's obviously such a big inspiration.
Yeah.
And Utrecht, I was there on tour with my orchestra, and they have an amazing music museum of musical instruments.
Yeah, it's called Museum for Speelklok en Pyramid, which means sort of like, well, it's an automated music box mm-hmm. museum. It's actually difficult to translate the title of the museum. Maybe you know it better than I do. But yeah, they have a huge collection of music boxes and organs and player pianos and I think they even have like a player string quartet.
Yes.
Don't they? Yeah.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, that's the one I would like to have. Would be great.
Actually, I really enjoy your string writing.
Oh, thank you.
We're going on these tangents. We have to come back to your album in a minute. But since we went there, that project in Paris, Different Shades of Grey. Can you speak to that? That seemed really interesting to me.
Yeah. In 2001, end of 2001. And then for 2 years, we had a chance to stay in a house in Paris. And it's a house built by Theo van Doesburg. Theo van Doesburg was one of the founders of the movement, the art movement, the Steel, with Piet Mondrian and Rietveld and those people. He was the sort of brain behind the whole art movement. And for himself, he was sort of a multiple disciplinary artist. He painted, he created color schemes, he was a graphic designer, and he was also an architect, and he designed a house for himself, a sort of a studio house, so with an atelier and things like that. And he was very inspired by Le Corbusier, and so he built that house for him. And it was in a small village right next to Paris, which now has become one of the what do you call that, suburbs of Paris. It's called Meudon. Mm-hmm. And he built that house in about 1927. They started building, 29 it was finished, and he died 3 months later. Mm-hmm. So he hardly lived there. But his wife, Nelly van Doesburg, lived there until 85. And after that, they decided to put it, well, she actually arranged that it was put into a sort of a foundation that would lend it to artists. And we stayed there for 2 years. So for 2 years, we were actually living in an art piece, because, I mean, you have to compare him to Mondrian. And at that time when we were there, the Dutch government was buying Victory Boogie Boogie, which is one of the biggest, the most important art pieces of Mondrian. Mm-hmm. And they bought it at that time for about 80 million euros or something like that. It's an incredible amount of money. And we were staying in a house that was sort of comparable to the Victory Boogie Woogie, not the same, but you know, you get the idea. You're living in an art piece. And also, while she was still living there, Nelly van Doesburg, who was an artist herself, invited a lot of artists to promote the steel movement. And she invited artists and other important people in art to come to the house. So in that house, Marcel Duchamp was there, Mahalo Nagy, the photographer, was there, but also Monk, the Thelonious Monk, stayed there. He actually had a relation with her. There's a piece dedicated to her, mm-hmm. Crepuscule to for Nelly. It's written by Monk, and it's dedicated to Nelly van Doesburg. And all these stories, it influences you. And I had to do something with it, staying there and, you know, being in that thing with such a history, and at the same time having Paris in the back, that huge city where so much goes on all the time. And especially at that time, Paris was jazz central for the world. There were so many concerts every weekend. There were weekends that there were 200 jazz concerts only in the area of Paris.
Wow.
It's just incredible. It's just incredible. And so I needed to do something about it. So I wrote a suite, which is called the Van Doesburg Suite. And the piece you were referring to and the writing you were referring to is part of that suite. Mm-hmm. So it's a suite that I wrote for my jazz impro chamber orchestra, Big Bizarre Habit. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of a chamber orchestra. I wanted to combine my experience with classical chamber orchestras, for which I wrote a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to combine that with my jazz view. And so it's an ensemble made up of a string quartet with players from classical world music and jazz and improvised music, the string quartet, and a horn section, trumpets, reeds and trombone, and then a rhythm section like we would have in the jazz ensembles with drums, double bass, piano, guitar, and a singer.
Yeah. It's excellent music.
Yeah.
There's so much to talk about, but let's circle back to your album, which is just released, The Lonely Coyote. Congratulations. Yeah. It's really,
thank you.
I've listened to it a lot. It's beautiful and interesting. And the way it starts, do you pronounce it Bung? How do you say that word?
The bang. First track. Bang.
Okay.
It's sort of like, I don't care how you would pronounce it. It's just sound because, thank you, by the way, for the remarks. That's very kind. But bang, it sort of reflects the sound when you pick up a 12-string guitar and you just hit it. It's sort of an explosion. Bang.
Yeah.
So it could have been graphically represented by something coming out of a Batman comic or something, you know, pow, bang.
So this is such an unusual album because you literally used a different acoustic guitar for each track.
Yeah. Some tracks have the same guitar, but almost, absolutely. I'm mesmerized by string sounds. String sounds in general. It doesn't limit, isn't limited to guitar, but guitar is sort of my thing. I do know exactly what the moment that I realized that this was so important to me. When I was about 12 years old, I already was playing a bit of guitar, but then I heard the intro to A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles. And there's this clang sound, very first chord there. When I heard that sound, I was just mesmerized. I just disappeared in the sound and I thought, wow. And then I knew this is what I wanted to do. And ever since I've been playing guitar, and I always remember that drive. Mm-hmm. It's always there. It's always part of my inspiration.
Yeah. So this collection of guitars, do you own all of them or did you borrow some of them for the recording?
No, these are the guitars that I own. I'm lucky to have found these guitars. For a guitar player, it's not unusual to have sort of quite a few different instruments because it's part of how we play and also it's more affordable than
yeah.
You would be doing that as a violin player. I think my whole collection doesn't even touch the price of a good violin, even though they're incredible instruments. But you know, the difference is huge. Yeah, so it's easy. Yeah, and I collected them during the time that I played, and sometimes I just run into something I realized that's the instrument that I need, and then I'll try to get something like that. Mm-hmm.
You've toured many, many places in the world. When you're touring, is there a preferred guitar that you take?
Yeah, that's a whole different thing. I would like to take them all. But it's become so difficult to bring instruments touring. Up to about 8 years ago, I would, in general, bring my Leven archtop guitar most of the time if I would be touring, because it's an acoustic instrument, and it's also an electric instrument, and I can do both, because I'm actually both. This album is The Lonely Coyote is only acoustic guitar, but a big part of what I do is playing electric guitar actually. So this album is also really a sidestep for me. This is the first time that I did an album purely on acoustic guitar. Mm-hmm. So usually I bring the Leven. It's an old jazz guitar, archtop. It's from the 60s, and it's a beautiful instrument acoustically, and it's an instrument that you can amplify more easily. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, it's almost impossible to bring a guitar like that. You'll have to at least arrange an extra seat in an airplane if you're traveling. So I'm mostly traveling with an electric guitar that I can take apart, take off the neck, and the body I'll bring in the cabin, and the neck goes into my luggage, checked luggage.
Okay.
And I'm running the risk that if I lose my baggage that I'm in trouble. But that's how I travel nowadays. And it works, until now, it works really good.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. I didn't know that even existed as a design feature. That's
yeah, hard. Well, actually, I sort of designed it myself, but I had somebody else create the parts for it. Yeah.
Are other guitarists using that now, that idea or the same plan for the guitar to come apart?
Yeah, there's tons of examples for that. There are even better solutions. Actually, a friend of mine who's a luthier designed something that you could really collapse and then bring it back, you know, straight away in one piece.
Like an umbrella.
Yeah, sort of. But this is disassembled in 10 minutes, in 5 minutes, and it's assembled and in tune in 10 minutes. So it goes really fast. Mm-hmm. So it works. Works for me.
Can you show us the guitars you have at hand?
This is my baritone guitar. It's a Loudon baritone. It's very different from a regular guitar, which is tuned with the lowest note being E. And this guitar
is tuned down a fourth, so it starts on a B, so it's very low. It's got a low resonating sound.
You want to see more?
Of course, yes.
Okay.
Well, the next guitar is my Martin 00021 from 1946. It's a guitar that's very dear to me. I always wanted a Martin guitar. And here they were almost impossible to find. So when we were touring for concerts in the US and Canada in the end of the 90s, I was looking for one, and we ended up somewhere in New York at the Mandolin Brothers, a huge guitar store, and they had a couple hanging there, and this one was hanging on the wall, and I picked it up, played a chord, and Ineke turned around and said to me, "That's the one you gotta buy." This is from Sunny Side Up. Yeah, it just has a beautiful sound. Mm-hmm. So that's the Martin. I was just talking about the bang and the incredible sound. Well, here's the guitar. This is another sort of piece of history for me. It's a 12-string guitar. I used to have a 12-string guitar somewhere in the 80s, and it was hand-built. It was a very special instrument. I got it because the instrument I had a warped neck, and I got to know this builder called Jaroslav Mach, who's actually a very famous classical guitar builder, and he lived near me. And I was a young kid. I was about 17 at that time, I think, and I had this guitar with a problem. So I went up to him, and he said, "I can't repair that guitar. It's not worth it. But you know what? I'll take the guitar and you buy for, well, I don't know. It was just very cheap. I could buy the 12-string guitar." So I had that for years, but it got broken at a certain moment and I lost it somehow. And so I've been looking for a 12-string ever since. And a couple of years ago, I saw one for sale, and that was this one. And it's from the 70s. And this is a Guild F512. And that's the 12-string guitar. If you want a 12-string guitar, that's the one you want to have. That's specifically from this period. And there was this guitar player who was selling it. And at the beginning, he didn't want to sell it because he got so many offers that were, you know, way beyond what I could pay. Mm-hmm. And then his girlfriend said to him, "You know what? You should sell it to that guy because he plays so much better than you do. And the instrument will be at the right place." And so he sold it for a very nice price. And I've been playing it ever since. For me, it's important because it's the instrument also that Ralph Towner, mm-hmm. who's one of my inspirations, uses on a lot of his recordings.
and it just sustains forever. And that's really special, because that is something you don't have usually on a guitar.
Do you play with nails or just picking with your hands? What's your technique like?
I'm sort of going back and forth with it. I'm not a classical player. Mm-hmm. I'm not trained as a classical player. I'm a jazz, I don't know, jazz player is how I view it. Mm-hmm. But I've always played acoustic guitar. I do play with my fingers. Mm-hmm. I'm always going back and forth with either using my nails or not using them. My nails are not very strong, so I keep losing them. I can do something about it, I know. But a lot of times I just don't want the sound of the nails, so I just want the sound of the fingers. And so it's a mixture. Mm-hmm. But I'm playing a lot of sort of hybrid stuff where I use a plectrum, mm-hmm, and a pick, and combine it with these two fingers.
Okay.
So, but then I'm limited to three notes, so I'll switch whenever I want the four notes at the same time. So it's a constant change. And it depends on the instrument as well. On the electric guitar, I might use a plectrum more often. Mm. On a nylon string, I will play more with my fingers, but I'm not really fast with my fingers, so then I will use a plectrum.
On the album, I noticed you had prepared zither as one of the instruments.
Yeah. You asked about the harp zither. It's a bit of a strange story. As I said, I'm crazy about stringed instruments, and at a certain point I started collecting all these weird zither harp like instruments just to make sounds with them. And actually I wanted to play percussion with them. I used to play percussion quite a bit, mm-hmm, when I was a kid, and I thought I could do something with that with stringed instruments. It never worked out, but nevertheless I did have these crazy sort of harps, and this one was the most craziest one I found. It was this one. Mm-hmm. I found it somewhere in a pawn shop in Utrecht. I think somebody made it by hand. It's actually terribly made, but and it's a strange thing, but it works really well if you sort of tune it a bit strangely and you do crazy stuff with it. Like, for instance, it's not tuned right now. So you can do crazy sounds with it, but I also prepared it. So for instance, I have this little thing here, mm-hmm, and you can just tune it to a certain overtone, or and then it resonates and things like that. And that I used on the very first piece, mm-hmm, and I tuned part of it. You get these koto-like.
Yeah.
But it's a hell of a job to tune it. So I did it for the recording, but I don't know whether I'm going to be using that live. It's going to be very complicated.
It was very effective, the way you used it. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think it turned out really well. But it was quite a job to get it to sound right. Yeah.
Yep. So, Mark, before you put it away, just for those people listening to the podcast who can't see it, let's just describe. So it's a large triangular wooden instrument with how many strings? Like what, 40? Like a lot?
I think it's about 20 strings or something. Mm-hmm. And it's a big triangle, yes. And the strings are grouped in sort of three groups, but it doesn't make sense. I never realized, never understood why it was made like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reason why I chose it is just because I could tune it in these crazy tunings and get these koto-like sounds and prepared sounds and these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It reminds me of two things. I was thinking a hammered dulcimer, it's similar, right? They just use hammers.
Yeah. There's an Indian instrument that is hammered, mm-hmm, also like this. There's an instrument, we call it hakkabord. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the English word would be for it. And there's a cymbalum, mm-hmm, which is used quite a bit in gypsy music. And it's more like a piano laid flat, and then they use sticks to hammer the strings. Yeah.
Years ago, continue.
Oh no, it's a bit like that. Yeah.
Years ago, somebody I knew like I wanted to play the guitar, but my hands are extremely small, and I just gave up. Although, somebody else I know said, oh, you could just get a much smaller guitar, which I guess I could do. But anyway, I never pursued it. And then someone said, oh, you should try the auto harp. It would be great for you. And they lent me their auto harp, which I found very awkward. It's not an instrument we see. I think it was used in that comedic movie with Catherine O'Hara about the, you know, the one I'm talking about with Eugene Levy. Something about it. Anyway, I can't remember the name of it. It was, she plays the auto harp. It was really funny.
Yeah. It's the auto harp is actually used in folk music quite a bit.
Yeah.
In the 60s, 70s, when we had like sort of, what do they call the second folk wave or something? They used to use that quite a bit. I think I have one, but a very old one, and it's hardly playable. It's actually a series of strings, and you just push a bar on top of the strings, and then it'll mute the strings that you don't want to use. And in that way, you can sort of form a chord.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's something that Joni Mitchell could have used on, mm-hmm. on some of her songs. It's sort of instrument. Isn't it Becca Stevens that she used it on one of her songs? You see it now and then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's a strange instrument. It's a different thing. Yeah.
Mark, that's a sign of a serious collector when you say, I think I have one.
Yeah, well, no. It's I'm not that big of a collector. In general, we have a sort of a rule. One thing goes in, one thing goes out.
And, do you want to talk a little bit more about your album, more of the songs and the inspirations?
Okay, yeah. Okay, The Lonely Coyote, the album, is a collection of 13 compositions, and it's actually the first part of a whole series of about 23 pieces for solo guitar and duet, and I recorded them about a year ago. I have my own sort of home recording studio. Actually, the room where we're in now is how I recorded it. Just set up two mics, sort of learned how to do it really well, and recorded the pieces here in my own room, my own workspace. The pieces are different from when they originated. These are the pieces that I wrote, and some of them I sort of later adapted them for another ensemble or for an orchestra or for there's lyrics to some of them, and this is sort of the original. And I wanted to record these pieces as they were intended in the first place. Because a lot of, I do write a lot of pieces that are intended to be played by or sung by somebody or played by a certain lineup. But some of the music I just write because, you know, it's for guitar. Mm-hmm. And these were intended just originally for guitar. And the inspiration of them varies. For instance, the first piece, Bang, really was just inspired by the 12-string guitar. And how can I do justice to the 12-string and write something that is sort of the proverbial 12-string thing? And one of the things that 12-string guitar in pop music, folk music, is mostly used for is a rhythm.
Mm.
And it's sort of a thing that creates a lot of drive, a lot of groove. And I wanted to write something, but at the same time, do something with sounds that would pay tribute to two of my 12-string heroes. One is Ralph Towner. The other one is Leo Kottke. Leo Kottke was one of do you know him, by the way? No. Okay. He is... sort of the 12-string guitar player from the 70s, 80s. There was a huge influence on the folk movement at that time. Mm. And he's actually still playing. And he did a lot of beautiful music on the 12-string guitar. So he was sort of a trendsetter, as was Ralph Towner. And Ralph Towner is more in the jazz area. And so I wanted to write something that would fit them. And the piece also has this sort of little figure that I think in Indian music they call tihai or something. That's like a repetitive sort of little figure that extends more and more and more. The second piece on the album, I'm not going to talk about all the pieces, but I mean, it's 13, so it's going to be too much probably. But the second piece is called The Lonely Coyote. And that was written in, I think, well, we were in San Diego at a house of friends of ours. And we were staying there for about 6 weeks to work on our music. And they live outside of San Diego in the mountains, close to the Mexican border. It's in the desert, beginning of the desert there. And they had a sort of an Airstream, you know, a trailer that where we could stay next to their house. So we had our private home. And I had they had a sea container. You call it a sea container?
Shipping container.
Shipping container, yeah. And they had one there, and that was sort of my workspace. You could open the doors, and, you know, it's San Diego, so the temperature is always great. So I was working there. And in between my working shifts, I would go out and would look out on the hill, you know, look at the nature. And you would hear the coyotes always. They were always there. They were trying to lure the dogs of our friends to come out. They would try to catch them. And one day I walked out and there it was in the field, just that one coyote looking at me. And it sort of reflected exactly how I feel when I'm sort of working. I'm sort of in my own little world, you know, lonely in that little world of music, finding your way, writing your music, but at the same time, you know, lost in your own music. When I'm writing, I sometimes feel as if I'm in that world, that little world of music, and you're just trying to find your way in there. And that coyote sort of reflected that. So the atmosphere of that piece is very inspired by that. Relating back to your first question, when you said, "What does inspire you in writing?" Mm-hmm. Well, that really was, and I wrote it originally as a guitar duet. I wrote it actually in tribute to Herberto Sismonti. At that time, we were talking with him about doing a joint concert here in the Netherlands, which we never managed to realize, but. That was one of the pieces that I sort of intended for that. Who knows, whatever happens, maybe we still get a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be doing.
I'm curious, Mark, about I'm always asking people these questions because it's interesting to me in terms of being in a state of flow. So because you're an improviser, I know you're often in that state and as a composer, but they're very different things in the sense that when you're... I'm actually, maybe you can just speak to that. How is it different for you from just improvising to composing?
There's a lot of similarity. To me, composing is a lot about improvising because it's sort of, in general, to me, composing is about, you know, that little bit of that is inspiration, which is very often just that tiny bit of what the piece in the end is. And most of what composing is what happens when you start fooling around, playing around with that little bit of inspiration. You hear that little thing in your head or you play something on your instrument and you think, wow, this is great. And then you start fooling around with it. You start creating material rising from that. And so that's why they very often say, you know, composing is 5% inspiration and 95% transpiration, which, you know, it's true. It's most of the time it's just
you know, work. You start fooling around, you play with material. I always feel very connected to visual artists. For instance, if you're working with clay, you know, you take this little piece of clay and you just start molding it, and then it becomes something and it changes, and you get inspired by the change. Okay, that's the next inspiration. You start fooling around, and then you keep building. And in composing, it happens the same way. It's always, there's something happening I like, I start playing around with it, I like that too, and then you build from that. I write down a lot of these little fragments, and they become a pile of notes on paper or in the computer, whatever. Sometimes it's just recorded. And this way I collect material. I always call that the collecting phase. And then I start looking for what do they have in common, and how can I combine them? How can I turn that into something that is coherent? And I know they belong together because I say so.
Yeah.
I'm the composer. I'm the artist. I can say this. But also, it's just because of time. They are connected. And I think I can... By now, I can connect anything that happens somehow within a certain time frame. And actually, even if it's not in that same time frame, by now I can connect almost anything. Because that's our freedom as an artist. We are allowed to make that decision. It's up to us. And I grew up as a composer in the 80s. And I had my schooling at the conservatory here in Utrecht as a classical composer and a pop and jazz composer. And classical composition at that time was contemporary music composition, and was very much influenced by all these things that were going on in the 80s. Serial music still was there, and all these variations, modern variations of serial music. A lot of music at that time was pretty rigid. Very, like, it should be like this, and if you do that, then you should be doing that, because if not, then you're not true to your material. And luckily enough, we're free from that sort of rigidity. Mm-hmm. Rigidity, you say that?
Yeah.
And we can playfully go with what we like. At the same time, I'm very pleased that I was trained at that time, because it's also nice to sometimes just restrict yourself and follow a rule. So sometimes I just set out a rule and I say, okay, it's going to be this material, and I don't want to use any other material. So limit yourself to that. So it all works to me. The most important thing to me still is that I feel connected to it, and my connection still goes back to that one chord of A Hard Day's Night. I can't play it because it's two chords on top of each other on two guitars.
Ah,
so you can never play it, that sound, create that sound on one guitar.
Got it.
But that connection and the inspiration that I got is still what sort of is my drive, and what is my sort of, how do you say that? My ruler to which I measure the quality of my music, or the how much I feel connected to the music. It's the same thing. It's the sort of the inspiration that gave to me has to be in the music I write, and I always feel connected. That's flow. That's
because you often write songs for Inika. Do sometimes the melodies come before the harmony? How does that work for you?
Very often, actually. Mm-hmm. Harmony is, in the way I write, mostly second. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, no, it's not always true. It depends. Sometimes I find these chords and then I'll hear the melody straight away. Mm-hmm. But for me, if I write a song, melody is more important in general than the harmony. Mm-hmm. But they are both connected. My sense for melody is a bit different than in general, I think in pop music. In a lot of music, the melody moves within the chords. In my music, I write quite a lot of melodies that are moving above the chords, which are embellishments. Mm-hmm. So I will use a 9 or a 13 or something like that, as a melody note, which makes it a bit far away from the original chord. Mm-hmm. And you create melodies that are more eerie, a bit, I don't know if that's the right word, but they are sort of, they feel floating on top. Mm-hmm. There's a composer that I actually got to know later in life that has the same way of writing, and I feel very connected to him. Kenny Wheeler, mm-hmm. you probably know him because he was Canadian and then moved to England. And Kenny does that too a lot in his music. He's beautiful writing, incredibly mm-hmm. strong. And
Did you meet him when you did the Banff session?
Yeah. We got to know. Yeah, we went to Banff in 91 and 93. And both times he was there. Actually, for us, that was a life changer, going to Banff. It totally created a new perspective on life as a musician, being there and getting to know all these incredible musicians and getting to know Kenny. Was incredible. We stayed in contact after that, and we recorded an album, our first album, in 94. Question Is Me is with him as a mm-hmm. featured guest, and we kept in contact ever since till he passed away mm-hmm. 5 years ago, I think. Yeah.
And when you went there, did you discover that the training in North America in jazz is more on the jazz standards to your training in Europe?
Well, what we saw at that time is specific, I think, for the time. I mean, we grew up in the 80s regarding our musical studies. So we went to the HK University for the Arts, so that's Utrecht Conservatory. Mm-hmm. At that time, there, when I entered the school, there was no jazz or pop department. Mm-hmm. And I actually wanted to study composition. But the composition teacher there, there was a classical composition teacher called Hans Cox, who was a pretty famous composer, classical composer here in the Netherlands. He said, well, you can enter. I'll accept you. But you have to enter as an instrumentalist as well. So mm-hmm. I had to study like crazy to be accepted for guitar. At that time, I entered the school for electric guitar, studying with Ave Albers, who was one of the jazz greats at the moment in the Netherlands. But there was no official jazz department. Mm-hmm. So the first 2 or 3 years, I was just sort of running in between everything. I was studying classical music. I was studying pop and jazz guitar, but there was no department yet. And only in the third year, we managed to convince the board that they should create a real department. And then they said, well, that's fine, but then you should do it.
Yeah.
So I was the first coordinator for that department, together with a piano player, Bert van der Brink. We were sort of setting up the department. Yeah. And then our training was very often that what the music that we were playing in the beginning, jazz music was mostly about the schooling was mostly about being a musician that was performing already. And you would go to the school to meet somebody that was sort of more experienced than you, and you would say, well, last weekend I played this song and it sounded not so good. What can we do about it? And so we would work on that song. And I would take it back on stage and see if it worked. If not, I would go back. And that was more of sort of the training, the kind of training for jazz and pop music. Mm. And yes, we did study standards as well, but not as much, because we were mostly focusing on our own music, and specifically me, because I was writing so much. Mm-hmm. So I was mostly playing my own music. When I came to Banff in 91, it was advertised as modern jazz, and it was with Steve Coleman teaching, and Cassandra Wilson would be teaching there for vocals originally. I think Kevin Eubanks was originally advertised to be teaching there. But when we arrived there, those people were at that time the headliners for modern jazz music in New York and everywhere. But when we arrived there, everybody was playing standards. And we were scared like crazy because that was not our thing. And so it was a hard time the first time. And the second time, I took my revenge because I was prepared. So I knew all the stuff. For 2 years, I studied like crazy. But yeah, people were more trained from a jazz perspective. Nowadays, here, it's a mixture. So it's not the same as it was when we started out.
I wanted to ask you about designing the program in Utrecht, because I'd read that you had helped design, and it said the Department for Jazz and Improvised Music, which I found interesting that was in the title.
Well, the Netherlands has a huge tradition of what they call free improvised music. Mm-hmm. In Europe, I think the Netherlands were sort of in the 80s were sort of looked upon as the place where free improvised music was happening. We did have quite a few ensembles, like the ICP Orchestra with Han Bennick and Michel Mengelberg and other people that were sort of the statues for that, or
proponents, kind of,
something like that. But music was very devised into those that were playing standards and those that would play improvised music, or those that would play pop music, mm-hmm. and very much in boxes. And to us, it was strange. We liked it all. I like free improvised music. I like standards. I like pop music. I like world music. I like classical music. So to me, it was always strange that there was sort of all these strict boxes. Improvised, we said jazz and improvised because jazz music for some people represents standards, and improvised music represents free improvised music.
Okay.
Nowadays, I think it's both. Mm-hmm. Boundaries are sort of lost. These boxes are most of the time gone. For some people, they are not, but in general, I think in the world scene, we get all these mixtures, and I love that. I think it should be like that. And what you see now at the schools is that a lot of young players grow up and don't think in these boxes totally at all, mm-hmm. whether it's classical or improvised or jazz, or, you have to learn your instrument from a certain perspective, and you need to dive into something for a period just to become good at the instrument. It'll help you to learn the instrument, mm-hmm. from a certain perspective. And after that, you're free to do whatever you think you can be doing. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't play everything, because that was something that was sort of strange to me, is that some people would always say that they were able to play everything. I never believed that. If you even if you trained as a classical player, you can't play every kind of classical music.
Yeah.
And if you're trained as a jazz player, you're bound to be specialized into certain things for certain things. And I think that's good. That's okay.
Yeah. I would say that most humans can only excel, let's say, in a more narrow range, but it doesn't mean they can't play other music badly.
No. And I think that's fine. That's fine. And it's also fine to sort of explore other music than the stuff that you're really good at. And you have to be cautious, because certain things you can better have people play because they're really great at it. I won't play classical guitar pieces because that's a very different world. Mm-hmm. It's also a different world in how you approach that instrument and how you form tone, and how you, that's a totally different thing.
Yeah, I shouldn't have used the word badly. I was just sort of doing that ironically from a perspective.
No, I understand. Yeah. I totally understand. Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, you were saying when you grew up in the small town, you had very limited resources in terms of the type of music you're able to hear. But that is good, because now I think people are overwhelmed. You can access everything, but maybe people don't focus in enough.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the biggest challenges, I think, for musicians growing up now, mm-hmm. is that there is so much available that it becomes too much. And then there's no choice made for you. So you have to deliberately make your choice, which is not easy. And combine that with the whole social media thing and with the... I mean, social media for a musician now gives you sort of a perspective as if everything is only possible when you're the greatest and the best in the world. And it's not, that's not a good mirror. I grew up in a time when I would go out to the town near to my village, 10 kilometers away from there. I would drive there on my bike to go out on Friday night, and we would visit the local jazz club, and there were musicians playing there. They would play there more often because that's how it went. And you would see them play, and our mirror at that time was them, the local heroes, those that would sort of play the music that you sort of liked, or at least you went out to listen to. And but they were doing it also in that sort of, that's in that world. It was that world. They were playing there. They were doing their thing in that world. So they were sort of a real image for you because it was a real image. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, if you reflect, if your sort of mirror is that incredible player that lives, I don't know, somewhere, well, in the States, looking at it from Europe, it's incredible to see them play, but their world is very different from ours, and is very different from when you grow up in a small town here. So somehow that sort of reflecting yourself to, or relating yourself to the local heroes sort of got lost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a loss. That's a loss. And it's something we see a lot with young students studying at conservatories, that they sort of hardly go to concerts of their own teachers because, you know, they can see whatever incredible name on YouTube. And so it's a different thing. There's a lot of good things about it because they can see it. It's available. But, you know, it brings other problems as well.
I remember years ago, I was preparing a violin piano recital, and I was telling my students and the parents of my students, you know, to come, and more than encouraging, like, I expect you to come. It's not something I do very often because I'm an orchestral player. And I remember one of the dads sort of being a bit bemused, like, this is important to you that they come. And I was like, yes, like, they should hear their teacher actually perform. But I've heard this many times, you know, that,
I think it's a problem from this time frame. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious how this will evolve, because it's really strange. The good thing is, there's, for instance, I in a project I did at the HKU a couple of years ago, I had a guy coming in from Nepal. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, because I was curious, he studied guitar, and I asked him, why did you come here, first of all? He said, well, there's nothing at that time in Nepal to learn about guitar, because it's a non-traditional instrument. There's no guitar teachers, and there's hardly any scene where I can play with other musicians. I said, but then how did you learn it? And he said, YouTube. So before he did his audition for the conservatory, the only teaching he had was YouTube, learning it from YouTube. So, I mean, that's the good thing about it. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. that's just incredible.
I was just thinking about your travels. You did a tour in Indonesia many years ago. Yeah. And I saw, I think, a photo of you collaborating with local musicians. Is that, did you jam with people, like playing traditional instruments? Was it gamelan?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, when we travel, we sort of like to do that a lot to collaborate with local musicians for two reasons, or three reasons. One, it's just inspirational to work with other musicians. Two, it's great to connect with the local scene because it'll put your music in a certain perspective and it might draw another crowd that as well. And the other thing is just a cultural exchange. It's specifically if you go to a country like that, like Indonesia. We've been there a couple of times, three times actually. And the last time was just before COVID in 2020. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just before COVID. Now 2019, December, we were there for about 3 weeks and we collaborated with some gamelan musicians in Yogyakarta. And also with some jazz players in Jakarta, but the collaboration with the gamelan players was incredible. It's incredible to do a collaboration like that because you're sort of then you have these two jazz musicians that play music that is sort of all about harmony and melody, and jazz music is about a lot of changing tonalities and stuff like that, and you collaborate with instruments that are limited by a pentatonic scale that is just one scale and one tuning, and that's how you deal with it, if I put it really bluntly. Mm-hmm. And then you work with musicians that just are so aware of what they do that they sort of easily adapt within the complexity of our music. And that's just so incredible. It's not like, we Western musicians sometimes like to see our music as being more elaborate or more evolved or something. And then you come in that country and they work from a perspective that traditionally their music is limited, but they just know how to adapt that into your music. And I think that is just incredible, just to be aware so much about the limitations that you can just use them in music that is where it's almost impossible to use it. So mm-hmm. you can use this note here, but you cannot use that note in the rest of the piece, but exactly on that part you can use it. Mm-hmm. You have that sort of awareness is just incredible. Mm-hmm. And these musicians that we collaborated with in Yogyakarta were just magicians mm-hmm. in doing that. It's just incredible.
Did you get to try any of those instruments, the gamelan?
Oh yeah, but forget it.
Yeah, just for fun.
Yeah, just for fun. But it's a totally different world. It's about rhythm. It's about an incredible complexity on rhythm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And have you ever been to Brazil?
Yes, I've been to Brazil, but it's a long time ago, 1981. I think, and I was there for about 3 months traveling, but I was really young and still very inexperienced as a musician. So, but we saw a lot of things there, and it was a crazy time at that time because Brazil was very far from the Netherlands. I remember that when we went there, my father said to me, I don't agree you going there because if something happens, I can't help you. That's too far away. We had to communicate by telegram and, we would send a telegram to our parents. So we arrived. Stop.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Like to go there, still have contacts. Actually, I got an invitation 2 weeks ago when my album... I send out the press releases of my album. I got an invitation to come down for a show there, but we'll have to see if that's going to work out.
It'll
be great. Yeah.
No, I was curious because we started the conversation with your early influence with Brazilian music. And
yeah.
One of your first ensembles, right? It was a Brazilian band.
It was a Brazilian a band. We used to play Brazilian influenced music.
Yeah. When you said you played a lot of percussion before, was it hand percussion or drum set or both?
No, hand percussion. Hand percussion. I played a lot of all kind of things: congas, Brazilian pandeiro, stuff like that, tambourine, all this stuff. But that's a long time ago. I'm not very good at it anymore. But it's, as soon as I started to seriously study guitar, I sort of stepped away from that because you have to focus. Mm-hmm. You have to focus. Yeah.
On that trip in Brazil, were you there during Carnival?
No, we were there in our summer. So that's their winter and so a different part of the year. But we just did see incredible amounts of music.
And as a teacher, you coached composition students for many, many years. What was your approach with that?
Oh, okay. I was a composition major teacher for about 30, 35 years or something. My approach in general is that I work from the perspective from the student. I have them sort of come up with material, and we start talking about what they are doing, what they want to achieve. And that's sort of that's my starting point. And that I use to create material for them to study. Because if they show what they are working on, if they come with their own sketches, then it becomes easy for me to sort of say, okay, I see you do this, maybe start working on that. For instance, if they come up with a song, which is very often the case, they've sort of written a song. And in general, when composition students come, they will come with some chords and they will come with a melody or something like that. Or sometimes just with some chords, and they say they have a melody, but then the melody is just the top of the chords, which is not a melody, it's the top of the chords. that's conversation number one. There's a difference between a melody and the top of your chords. It immediately creates the material that they have to work on. In the first case, where they don't have that melody, is start writing a melody. And then you'd start talking about melody and what's actually a melody and when is a melody good and when not. And there's this whole series of exercises that I use in that that'll train somebody to write better melodies. And some of those rules go back to my classical composition teacher that would have me write melodies in whole notes for weeks, just whole note melodies. Start doing that. You can use a scale, you can use a row, you can write it in a sort of mode, whatever. But then write a good melody that is only composed with whole notes, and it'll tell you a lot when you start doing that. And then after a while, you know, start using half notes, and what's the difference? And then you start learning that there's accented and non-accented notes, and when you use quarter notes, this evolves. There's a whole system that'll sort of train you into better writing. And it's not that is how you should be writing, but when you're writing and you want to evaluate what you're doing, it's nice to go back to sort of these basic exercises, because by doing that, coming from the perspective that you already wrote something, it'll put it in a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's only for that I do it. I never tell somebody you have to do it this way or that way. But I will always try to sort of keep a mirror in front and say, okay, you're doing this, but there's something that you should sort of become aware of. And exercises like that are part of it. So that's one way of approaching it. The other thing could be working on harmony, because, I mean, a melody very often dictates harmony already by itself, because very often it's in a tonality, and then, you know,
there's all this whole tradition of how functional harmony works, and it goes back to anything in classical music up to everything in non-classical music. But then there's also a way of looking at melodies where they ask for a different kind of harmony, and then you will sort of step away from functional harmony. Functional harmony being everything that goes follows the rules from, you know, 1-4-5 or 2-5, mm-hmm. 1 or, you know, 6, etc. Chord steps, stuff like that. So that's an approach. And so there's so many ways of looking at this. And this is still within the scope of, okay, there's a melody and a harmony, but there's so much more. There's rhythm. There's, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of subjects to touch upon. Mm-hmm. But I like to sort of approach it not from a perspective from you have to do this, but from the perspective from, okay, you're doing this and you want to learn more. Okay, what you do is what you know already, but now let's do the next thing and learn to work from there.
And you had a mentor who didn't teach any other students. You had a couple of sessions with, who was very famous in the Netherlands, whose name I can't pronounce. So if you could.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I had several teachers, but most of the time, one of them, the one you're referring to, is Rogier van Otterlo. Rogier is quite famous in Europe, actually beyond Europe, because he was the conductor of the Dutch Metropole Orchestra, which is the Dutch radio orchestra. It's mm-hmm. actually, I think it's still one of the only, it was for a long time, the only professional full-time broadcasting orchestra of that sort of format. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time they are sort of combinations of radio orchestras are sort of assembled specifically for the occasion. In the Netherlands, we had one that was sort of dedicated to jazz and pop music, mm-hmm. And film music. And it was the Metropole Orchestra. They are still there. They're an amazing orchestra, still doing a lot of work. And one of their conductors was Rogier van Otterlo. He wrote a lot of music, and he conducted the orchestra from sort of beginning of the 80s till his death in somewhere 86, I think, for about 6-7 years. And I was one of his only students that he ever had. He didn't want to teach. Mm-hmm. But my teacher at that moment, Henk Alkema, who was teaching at the Utrecht Conservatory, said, you have to get him to teach you. And he phoned him and he said, you have to teach this guy. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. But there was a workshop every year of the Metropole Orchestra, and I would show up with a piece, and he would look at the piece. And, you know, even in my first year, I showed up with an orchestra piece, which was kind of crazy. He looked at the piece and he said, well, it's way too complicated. We cannot play that in one rehearsal. And if it's not possible to play it in one rehearsal, we won't do it. So next year I showed up with another piece. And so in the end, he was interested, and he said, well, okay, come by. So I could come, and then he would review my music and talk about what he, mm-hmm. How he looked at the composing and stuff like that. Yeah,
I was listening to some of his music yesterday. He wrote some for very many famous films, which brings me to another question, because you've written for silent film, right?
Yeah. That's a project I did in 96, I think. Yeah. These are, it's a project where I work with the films of Georges Méliès. Georges Méliès is a French how do you call it?
Cineast, I think.
Yes, well, filmmaker.
Yeah.
He started out in the beginning of the 1900s. He saw the brothers Lumière, who are sort of said to be the first to create moving pictures. He saw them. He himself, Méliès, was a vaudeville artist. He was a magician. Mm. He performed mostly in these vaudeville theaters where, you know, you have to imagine the 1900s where in the theater you would show up and there would be
a dance act and a clown and music, and then maybe a little bit of theater. And then he would do work as a magician. And he saw the possibility to use film in his vaudeville theaters. So at that time, at the, where the Brothers Lumiere did their shows, it was part of a vaudeville theater. So they would show, for instance, a film, a little film of maybe 2 minutes, where a train would run into a station and it would run right up to the audience. And you have to realize at that moment, it was the first time people would see the live film. Mm-hmm. And when that train ran in, people ran out of the room because they were afraid to be hit by the train. Méliès created all these fantastic travels to the moon. Voyage à l'impossible is one of his movies. Voyage à la lune is a one. That's a very famous one where they travel to the moon and they crash on the moon. And I think most people must have seen films of Méliès. They're a combination of drawn material, filmed material, staged. It's really crazy. And I did a program where I wrote music to some of his films, about eight or something, and we performed them live, and we had a video artist perform his, a video artist, a contemporary video artist, whose work really, sort of his method really resembled that of Méliès. And he performed those videos live on stage, and then we alternated that with the films of Méliès. And my chamber, a small version of my chamber orchestra performed live to that music. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you've been involved with so many different projects.
That's I wrote a lot of orchestral music for the project with the Metropole Orchestra. We did a big project in 2000, I think, where I wrote most of the music with Vince Mendoza conducting. He used to be the conductor for about 15 years or 10 years or something. Mm-hmm. And also with John Clayton conducting. Written a lot of that kind of music, choir music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Mark, at the beginning of this conversation, you said, I can go get my arch top.
You want to see my arch top?
Yes.
So this is it's an old guitar from the 60s. I found it somewhere in 97, I think. Somebody was just putting it up for sale. Mm-hmm. And I, somewhere in the north of the Netherlands, and I drove for about, 2 hours to go there. I saw the guitar and I thought, this should be it. And I've been using it. I've been touring with it all over the world. I've taken it to Canada, I've taken it to the States, taken it to Indonesia, to everywhere. It has gone from the desert to in San Diego, near San Diego, to the humid climate of Jakarta, and it's still in great working condition. And because I took it to Banff in 2000. When I was doing a residency there, and humidity there goes down to about 20%. So this guitar was sort of almost falling apart. And then a year later or 2 years later, I took it to Indonesia again, and where it was so wet that it would swell. Mm-hmm. And, so it has had some abuse, but it's still there.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for your perspectives and your stories and your beautiful music today, Mark. It was wonderful to meet you.
Okay. That's likewise. Thank you for inviting me. It was really, it's nice to be talking about the music. And thank you for all the attention also you're giving to my music and specifically to my new album, The Lonely Coyote. So thank you so much.
The link for the album, of course, will be in the description so people can go right there and buy it.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Really good.
Okay. Have a good day.
Yeah, same to you.
My life is so enriched by getting to know these incredibly inspiring creative guests and their perspectives on their lives and music. Please follow this podcast and sign up for my podcast newsletter to get sneak peeks for upcoming guests and find out about newly published transcripts.